It's the New Books and Literary Studies podcast. I'm your host, Philip Woodavine, and today I'm joined by Emily Troshenko. Dr. Troshenko is a research associate at the University of Oxford in the Faculty of Medieval and Modern Languages. Her first monograph is Kafka's Cognitive Realism, which is a kind of reevaluation of Kafka according to modern cognitive science. That's the book we're going to be talking about today. Very happy it's brought Emily to the show. Emily, thanks for being on.
Thank you for the invitation.
All right, so I just wanted to quote you from the introduction to get a sense for what a cognitive realism might be. You write, "This study will proceed from the assumption that what a literary work is can be best understood by investigating what it does." So this seems to be where you could begin to leverage the real cause and effect of the cognitive sciences to understand how and what literature is actually doing. So I was wondering if you could just kind of talk about that, how you bring a scientific method to something that's historically been more abstract, less empirically observable, I guess.
So I guess what I was getting at with that distinction between being and doing partly arises from the tradition in literary studies of trying to come up with interpretations of texts, so statements essentially about what texts mean. But without necessarily much awareness of or indeed interest in how we get to making those statements in the first place. So what the nature is of the kinds of interactions that are happening between the text and the reader. So that means that you'll typically find statements being made as though they have some kind of universal relevance, like the text means this. But eliding the idea that actually this was a very private individual reading experience that led to this conclusion, and talking about the reader instead of, well, I, all kinds of little tropes like that you start to pick up when you begin to take another perspective and ask, what is it about this aspect of the text that's making me respond in this way, or what is it indeed about some aspect of my life history or what I'm doing now that's making me respond like this. So once you start to ask those kind of questions, then all kinds of new methods open up to you. And I guess the cognitive literary studies at the moment, at least the empirical branch of that area, is gradually trying out all kinds of methods that are more and less viable. I mean, they're essentially two kinds of thing that you can do if you want to investigate stuff like this empirically. One, you can ask people about their experiences, or two, you can try and get at the nature of their experience or their processing of the text in some more indirect way. Obviously, both have drawbacks. So with the first method, you have to rely on people's introspective abilities, and people aren't always they're not always aware and or able to articulate everything about their experience or what fed into that experience. But then on the other side, if you're doing things like eye tracking or measuring reading times or other physiological measures, or of course brain imaging, which is getting hugely trendy in this area too, you're not actually measuring, you're measuring something else, and the relation between that something else and what you're actually interested in may be quite hard to pin down. And of course, you start intruding into the reading experience more and more then. So if you've got people hooked up to an eye tracker or obviously sitting in an fMRI scanner, then start to change quite significantly. So there's all kinds of empirical challenges. But I guess the point is that you're able to, as you say, start to disentangle cause and effect a bit, and say, if you take a whole bunch of readers and you've got a textual feature of a particular kind, it's on average likely that it will have this kind of effect. And that's really interesting if we're curious in general about, what makes us read fiction in the first place.
Mm-hmm. So from what I'm hearing, it sounds like we're trying to, in that area of cognitive literary studies, it seems like you're trying to generalize the reader from an actual sample of living, actual readers, that you're, I guess, treating their responses, their introspection, not so much as the actual interpretation, the final universal meaning of it, but more like as data a little bit. Does that sound correct?
Mm, yeah. Yeah, obviously humanities people often hate the word data, and they'll talk mm-hmm. about reductionism as a sort of dirty word. And I think data are great because they can help us move towards conclusions that are more robust than simply a hypothesis that I might come up with based on my own single reading experience. It's important not to be too broad brushed about it too, though. I mean, some of the earlier experiments, and indeed experiments happening now, very much flatten out all kinds of individual variation between reading participants, and also can have slightly problematic assumptions about some kind of blank slate reader or some kind of, you know, standard non-expert reader who mm-hmm. will have certain qualities, and also perhaps make assumptions about that blank slate reader being in some way more reliable than a literary critic who spent their whole life learning how to read really well. And obviously that doesn't go down too well with more traditional literary scholars who feel that expertise does have a value, and of course it does. So it's difficult to get the balance right between valuing and taking seriously individual, you know, singular reading experiences, and also saying, well, let's put this in context, let's explore the commonalities between people as well as the differences. I guess that's something that for me has often been quite frustrating about humanities research, is that there's so much more emphasis on the specialness of individual readings, to the complete exclusion of stuff that we do share as human beings. There's a lot more that's similar about us than what differs between us. And it's nice to try and come to a better understanding of that stuff too, I think.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And especially given, the methods that, the principles that you're trying to bring to bear on like the problems of literary interpretation. So I just trying to draw conclusions based on actual reader responses. I did notice that you had two empirical studies in your appendices. I was curious maybe how you personally have been approaching that challenge of understanding what we have in common.
Yeah, it's certainly been a challenge. Both the experiments that I refer to in this book were, well, particularly the first one was a hugely steep learning curve for me. And the first experiment was one that I carried out during my PhD. I had all kinds of advice from very knowledgeable and well-meaning psychologists who told me to do something completely different and much simpler. And I ignored them all and went ahead with my completely overambitious, it was a way of trying to get away from the standard kind of psychology rating scales and very predetermined formats for people to respond in. I wanted to, I suppose, allow people to say whatever came up when they were reading a bit of Kafka, rather than ask them about things that I thought I was interested in.
Your initial definition of realism comes from, I think, a reader response. You ask someone to define realism, and that's kind of how you opened up the discussion on what is real, what is realism. So I guess to get back to the book, or the main gist of the book, the focus when trying to understand cognition in Kafka's writing is on visual perception in particular. So I guess I kind of wanted to ask you a bit about why vision, and how did vision become the important aspect of cognition you were going to focus on?
Well, I'd written a proposal for my doctorate that was very properly mainstream literary criticism. It was all about representation of space in modernism, and I it made sense and was a kind of interesting-ish question, I suppose, but not really for me. And I got very cold feet about it just before I started the PhD and talked to my parents, who were both psychologists, and they said, in the typical scientist way, well, what's the question you're really trying to answer? Is there one? Because if there isn't, maybe you shouldn't go ahead and do 3 or 4 years of very intensive, lonely scholarship. I realized that I did have a question, and it was, why is Kafka's writing so brilliant? Why do I still want to read it all this time after it was written? And what makes it so powerful? My intuitions about space hadn't been entirely wrong. I think there is something strange going on with space in Kafka, but actually I gradually realized that it's less space and it's more about how we perceive space. Vision is a huge part of that. Of course, it's not the only part, and people quite rightly get annoyed when vision is, as it often is, prioritized over all the other senses and treated as the only one that kind of matters. It clearly isn't, but it is a very dominant sense in human cognition, and it's responsible for a lot of the characteristics of how we experience the world around us. And I think Kafka is doing some really interesting things specifically with the representation of vision and its imaginative corollary, mental imagery or vision-like imagining.
Yeah, there's a really interesting parallel drawn between visual perception and imagined perception or percepts that are things you're perceiving that are totally imaginary. So I guess a big part of, the thing that struck me reading this was that something could be real or could affect us as real only because we perceive it that way. Like, we would have the reaction towards something frightening in Kafka, in the same way that we would react to something really actually physically, frightening. So it seems like there's, the study is sort of getting into, there's a certain level of cognition, where our visual systems are like really seeing the fiction, even though it's just symbols on a page, we're having a reaction to something as if it was real. So, I was wondering if you could go into that and how, or whether or not there's a point after which, an imaginary person, place, or phenomenon is indistinguishable from an actually perceived one, at least to a certain part of our mind.
Yeah, I guess this was the idea that I was trying to sort of feel my way around in coining the term. Well, if I did coin it, I guess some people have used it before, but what I mean by cognitive realism is this correspondence that can be created between how aspects of perception are depicted in a text and how they are understood to act in the real world. So I think Kafka is doing that, is creating that kind of correspondence really with quite interesting precision a lot of the time. And we see this particularly in the evocation of how vision works. I think that things are represented in a way that corresponds not to how we normally think of vision as working. But perhaps if the theories which I've summarized and I'm to some extent relying on are correct, corresponds with how it actually works. So we sort of get past the folk psychology and we get to some really deep rooted alignment between what's given in the text and how our minds work. And that isn't complete. I wouldn't want to say that he is systematically just prefiguring a whole load of cognitive scientific discoveries or anything, but there are interesting parallels that I think are at least partly responsible for that odd kind of potency that his language has. So, go on.
Yeah, I was reading and I was really surprised to read that language is processed. You write language is processed by both the perceptual and the motor system. So it's, I mean, the part of you that's in charge of moving you, like your response is as physical as your motor system, which I think is fascinating. I guess maybe to get at the question a little more precisely, I guess I should ask, like what's going on in a reader's head when they're really engaged with something like Kafka, for example, and where does that begin to differ from the folk psychology or the folk assumption about how vision works and how imagination works in that way or visually?
So you've obviously got a whole mass of complicated stuff going on. So at the kind of lowest level, you've got all the eye movements that are serving to take in the visual stimuli, the stuff on the page, decode the letters, then do all the sort of semantic comprehension. And there'll probably be feedback loops between the basic text processing and the comprehension processing, comprehension side of the processing. And then building on top of that, then you have the stuff that's about engaging with the content of what you're reading. So you'll have a kind of emotional appraisals in response to the characters. You'll have some kind of mind reading or, you know, theory of mind type response. So either making inferences about characters' states of mind or in some more direct sense, perceiving those states. And as you say, you'll have all the motor stuff. So you'll have low level physiological responses to all kinds of descriptions of actions and settings where certain actions are likely to occur. And part of that motor response is the perceptual response that we've started talking about. So I guess the standard folk psychological and sort of basic early scientific model of how vision works is that you move your eyes around the scene, you take in visual information, travels up the optic nerve into the brain where it's processed and successively with more and more eye movements, you put together some kind of mental or neural representation of the scene, and that's what allows you to see the stuff that you're looking at. So this kind of seems to make sense as far as it goes, but when you start to ask how that mental representation actually allows us to have the experience of seeing something, it gets a bit more tricky. Because what is the nature of that neural representation? There's good candidates. So primary visual cortex, for example, is known to represent the current stimuli in a retinotopic fashion, i.e. Corresponding to the patterns of stimulation on the retina. So you can kind of decode backwards from looking at V1 to what you were seeing. But even if you can do that, there's all kinds of distortions. And of course, nothing's in 3D, nothing's in color. You're not explaining a whole lot of stuff. And you're certainly not explaining why that should give rise to some kind of experience at all. You're also probably relying on some kind of little, some kind of homunculus, some kind of metacognitive agent who looks at the that neural display, reads the stuff off it, and then you know, uses it to know what's being seen. So then you're in a position where you have to explain how that homunculus is functioning. And this kind of model is still very much present in current scientific theories. People will actually talk about, in scare quotes, but seriously, like the mind's eye function and things like that. But you have this huge lot of unexplained stuff, and you have what Dave Chalmers called the hard problem, the problem of why physical processing should give rise to subjective experience at all. So that's very acutely posed by that type of model of perception. And so alternative models have been proposed that say, in fact, seeing doesn't rely on building up an internal representation of what is being seen. You don't need to do that, these kind of theories, inactive theories or sensory motor theories say, because well, it's all out there in the world for you to look at when you need to. So why would the brain bother to put together a very computationally costly representation? Doesn't need to. So instead, the idea in this kind of theory, and it varies between kind of sub-theories, but the basic idea that is that seeing is more about interacting with your environment. So it's interacting with your surroundings with mastery of the relevant laws of sensory motor contingency, or in ordinary language, with a knowledge of what would change if I were to move in a certain way, or the object that I'm looking at were to move. A very low level detailed knowledge of those contingent interactions when it comes to reflectance and contrast and size and perspective and so on, built up over a lifetime of perceiving stuff. So that's kind of, that's the alternative and active model of perception. And that's the one that I think Kafka is tapping into really quite directly by, I think it's really striking once you start to think about it this way, because he so often just doesn't give you nearly as much detail as you were probably expecting in descriptions and stuff. And often I think you don't really notice that until you start looking for it, because you read it really easily and it you know, you just flow through it so naturally. But there are a huge number of gaps, and gappiness is one of the main perceptual characteristics that theories like inactivism try to account for. You know, we like to think that we have a hugely detailed model of the world available to us at any point, but we really don't. And popular demonstrations of things like change blindness or an inattentional blindness with the gorilla who walks through the basketball game, these things show that we, you know, we can just miss huge things right in front of us all the time, and that our grasp on our surroundings is much more precarious than we might like to think. So I think Kafka's playing with that and using it to unsettle us, but also drawing us in, because it really does correspond to how we engage perceptually with real environments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, when you began to define the term Kafkaesque, or at least what's called Kafkaesque, if it's not a real quality in Kafka's writing, is as something that's both compelling and unsettling. So it seems like you're trying to better understand something that, some aspects of visual perception that might be more precarious than we might think of or assume. So I want to kind of get into how you apply these ideas to some actual Kafka, some actual bits of Kafka's writing. In chapter 3, after having built up these ideas and having sort of begun to establish your position in like the inactivist camp, I guess, or with the sensory motor theory of visual perception, we get into like a really interesting analysis of the opening of Der Prozess, or the trial. Is that the right name?
Yeah.
Der Prozess. I remember it's Der Prozess. You say that the immediate environment exists only insofar as K, the main character, K interacts with it. But what little we know about it is perfectly adequate, perhaps, because simply mentioning a movement or action creates a greater effect of cognitive verisimilitude. It seems to me it's like when you talk about gappiness, it's like the spaces in between frames of a film where our brain is just sort of filling in the rest and making it contiguous and making objects seem permanent in their movement. So I was hoping you could go a little further into how Kafka is I guess evoking an imaginary perception that seems real, and just how, and in just what ways it's real given the inactivist account of perception and that.
So that passage that you talk about is probably my favorite bit of Kafka, and I think it is remarkable how little it says, and yet at least for me, and I think for many other people that I've talked to, how little you miss all the detail that you might normally expect. So, you know, you really don't know anything about where the protagonist K is waking up. until you learn that he sees something from his pillow. And so you can infer that he's in bed. And then it says there's a knock. So you kind of infer that he's in a room with a door. And you know, it proceeds like that, very much from just very minimal hints, to create something that just works, that you just kind of take for granted. And whether you do fill in all the gaps or not, I'm not sure. I think this is part of the, the entailments of the inactivist theory, is that there will be lots of gaps and you may not even feel the need to fill them. It may just not be necessary. So this is, I think, one of the things that makes the reading process flow in a slightly different way from, you know, perhaps a more traditional 19th century realist text, where you would have a long description of the room before something happened in it. Because you don't have to pause to have the visual description and then get on with the action, because it's actually the action that is giving you the description. All that you need of the description is there in the stuff that the protagonist does or doesn't do. So the world of the trial sort of gradually expands in that way, just giving you very little, gradually bringing in hints of other places that there are, usually also through action. And then starts to sort of give us hints of the ways in which perception works if it's not conceived of in this pictorialist way. So if it's not about building up mental pictures, but about something more action bound. So there'll be moments where, for example, you just come into a room and it's all there just all at once without you having to do some kind of cumulative building up of the picture of the room. So he walks into some ultra crowded sitting room and it's just as if he could have seen all the detail already, even though he couldn't possibly have, because probably had time for a very few eye movements. And so you get sort of, again, little challenges to that usual way of thinking about vision. And then you have little ways that vision starts to merge with imagination more. Things start to feel a bit weird and not quite make sense. And for example, the famous lumber room scene where he at work walks into a room where one of his colleagues is being beaten by another. And it's not clear whether this is entirely real or not. And in a way, it's just a normal room on this normal corridor. But then he comes back, he closes the door and sort of the screams are muffled. And then he comes back again and finds that, in fact, nothing has changed from when he was last there. And so you get this horrible sense that actually maybe it's just some sort of figment of his imagination. And it becomes very, the kinds of indeterminacy that you get in the descriptions of that room and the kinds of ways in which his actions do or don't affect the room itself become, you become more acutely aware of those things and of the ambiguities that they create, because we just can't completely be sure of the boundaries between the seen and the imagined anymore.
Yeah, I mean, if you have something that seems so real, when it begins to get weird or it gets to become, when it begins to move into those spaces or into those situations that could only exist in a fiction, then, and once you've already been sucked into the realism of it, it must be very disconcerting. So that is very cool. And that's kind of the big picture take, if you forgive the expression, that I'm getting from what's cool about Kafka. Maybe what the answer to your question is, at least for me, is that Kafka is sort of brilliant in that he can make you feel like you're actually in a place that you've never been to and that doesn't actually exist and that fantastic things can happen. And so
very normal as well. I mean,
Right.
The weirdness just creeps up on you, I think, rather than being, you know, it's not surreal from the outset. It just gradually takes over, I think.
I kind of got through the main body of my questions, but I have a couple of tangential questions that I kind of wanted to throw at you and see how you respond to them. They're not really about what you wrote about, but they sort of apply. So The whole idea of something that can exist only in effect or virtually, that's super interesting to me. And so that something could be qualified as existent only because it makes you feel like it is, sort of. I wonder, as virtual reality, VR, is becoming more and more culturally relevant, is becoming more part of our media and entertainment, I wonder if you think there's an activist take, a Kafka-esque take on cinematic VR. Is there, do you see, is that something you've ever thought about? Do you think that, just in terms of a director of a film, if you're directing an audience's attention in a virtual experience, in the same way that Kafka's writing is a virtual experience, do you think that there's opportunity to explore that kind of aesthetic effect on people? Do you see that as being an object of cognitive literary studies? Do you think that there's any applications of your own conclusions, your own thinking on that kind of interaction of text and mind, if we think of the virtual experience as a text?
Gosh, lots of questions. I don't know a huge amount about virtual reality stuff, but I guess one of the obvious points of connection is this idea about expectation and how much you need to be given in order to draw certain conclusions about your environment, say. So there's lots of evidence about the extent to which, you know, what we expect to see drives what we do see. All the change blindness stuff that I mentioned, but also in a more general sense, the idea of something that's becoming very very exciting and fashionable in cognitive science at the moment, predictive coding or Bayesian theories of cognition. People like the philosopher Andy Clark, for example, are saying this is going to just revolutionize cognitive science. It's all about the idea that what the mind is doing is trying to account for the incoming sensory data by matching it with some kind of top-down prediction. And the idea is to minimize the prediction error. So in that kind of model, the actual incoming data is only significant if it proves your prior prediction wrong and forces you to revise your model. Otherwise, it doesn't necessarily matter hugely what the incoming stuff is. If it corresponds to your model, then it's almost redundant. So I think maybe that kind of idea and the thoughts about inactivism that we've talked about give you a way of thinking about the construction of virtual environments in a slightly different and a slightly more parsimonious way, I guess, because you're not having to just like Kafka is kind of getting away from this very long entrenched idea in poetics that creating a vivid reading experience requires you to paint a verbal picture. You can get away from that idea maybe in other media as well, and actually give people these hints, give people all the gappiness and see what they do with it and whether they even notice it. I think you're seeing some of that applied to in artificial intelligence contexts, you know, people trying out these less representationless models of perception and seeing whether they work better in robots. And it seems to get around a lot of the problems of like computational demands and actually work quite well. So I think, yeah, there's lots of interesting stuff that could be done there. I don't know how much cognitive literary studies will contribute, but I hope it will get involved in all kinds of exciting stuff like that. Cause I guess this is one of the main excitements for me of doing cognitive as opposed to other kinds of literary work is that you can really feel that you're in a dialogue with a whole lot of other burgeoning, fast-moving fields rather than in sort of a bit of a backwater, which it felt to me as an undergraduate that the field was. And not that we should, I think people who are more perhaps traditionalists in thinking about these things perhaps worry that, you know, if we're entering into a dialogue with the cognitive sciences, well, we're just going to be the sort of poor sister who has nothing to contribute. I absolutely don't think that's the case. And I, although this book is primarily taking scientific insights and seeing what can they say about Kafka, I'm more and more interested in how we can say stuff back and how we can, you know, adapt empirical methodologies to work well for telling us about literary reading, yes, but also then by extension about how minds work in general. Just contributing to those debates in a very equal and two-way fashion. I think that's what I really hope that cognitive literary science, or whatever you want to call it, will end up doing. So yeah, virtual reality, definitely. If we can, that would be excellent.
Yeah, I just have one last question for you. You write that this investigation is really only in the early stages, and so that many questions have to remain just questions, or at least they might become better defined questions. I'm wondering, this book was published in February of 2014. I'm wondering what's occupying you now in your work, in your research, and what are you working on now?
I guess I've gone a little bit further down the route of thinking about differences between readers. So I have a long-standing interest in mental health from my own experience, past experience here, and writing a blog about eating disorders. And I've now just started to put those interests together with my literary stuff. I collaborated with an eating disorders charity, Beach, last year, starting to investigate the connections between people's reading habits and their mental health, and got some really fascinating stuff out of the survey that we conducted. And I'm just starting to design empirical work that will start to, again, you know, get at the potential causal mechanisms, both mechanisms of therapeutic benefit and potentially harm as well. I think there's a huge amount to be learned there, and lots of assumptions about, you know, how literature must be good for us in certain ways, but these assumptions are not very often rigorously tested, so it'll be interesting to do that. That's actually becoming really satisfying and a really nice way of linking interests of mine that have been quite distinct until this point. Thinking about mind-body feedback obviously becomes very important in the context of disordered eating. So I've just finished a paper on that, thinking about how feedback, positive feedback loops in particular, can be thought of as quite important to reading in general, but also particularly reading when we have mental health problems in the picture. So that's kind of where I'm going at the moment.